We send our kids to school to be educated, empowered and enlightened, to enable them to achieve their greatest potential. Meanwhile, though, we have an epidemic of childhood obesity, a situation with significant physical, mental, emotional and social consequences. So has our education system contributed to the problem of obesity? Could schools be part of the solution? Stand by. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Hello and welcome to Go Healthy for Good. At 36 years of age, Chris had a distressing experience as a new school principal. He reminisces about his own school education before that fateful day. Watch.
When I was in high school, I was a swimmer. I ended up going to nationals my senior year in high school and went to college on a swimming scholarship. I remember doing a fitness test my junior year in one of our classes, and for part of the test, they did body fat, and then they did cardiovascular, and they also did strength. And the body fat, I think I was 5.5. The strength for push-ups, we had to do push-ups down to somebody's fist, how many you could do in a minute, and I did 56. And so that was in college. So I was in outstanding physical condition. I swam about 7,000 to 8,000 yards a day at the time, plus lifted weights, and maintained a decent grade point average. And when I got out of college, I became a teacher, and I stopped swimming because life kind of happens. I got busy, and I stopped taking care of myself. I put on weight. I went from my swimming weight in college at 165. Up to about 215 in a pretty short period of time, and it wasn't muscle weight that I was gaining. So I taught, and then I applied for and received a principalship, my first one, in Stanley County, North Carolina. We had a preschool student who was involved in, she had been abused, and she was in a lot of pain. And I remember that day very distinctly. She was out in the hallway, and she was crying because she was hurting. And that was at about 1 o'clock. And we got, you know, care involved, police involved, et cetera. They were already on site, and got the child taken care of. But at about 4 o'clock, I still wasn't feeling right. And I called one of my paraprofessionals who was also on the volunteer fire department. Her name's Diane Frick. I called Diane and I said, "Diane, what are you doing?" And she said, "Chris, it's 4 o'clock. Why are you calling?" And I said, "Well, I just kind of don't feel right. I was wondering if maybe you could come up and take my blood pressure." And she said, "I'll be right there." She walked in and in her southern motherly voice said, "Boy, are you having a heart attack?" And I said, "No, I'm fine." And she said, "Chris, do you have any pain?" And I said, "No. I feel fine." And she said, "Nothing in your arm, nothing in your jaw." And I said, "No, just take my blood pressure so we can move on." And she took my blood pressure, and it was 157 over 109. And when she told me that, I looked at her and she looked at me and I said, "I lied. My chest hurts. I'm having some pain up into my jaw." And she said, "I'm calling an ambulance."
Later on the show, we find out what happened next, and Chris will also be our expert guest as we explore the topic of healthy schools. Sean's here again to get us on the move, and there's a yummy recipe from Chef Mark Anthony that's designed just for us. So let's get things rolling with the news. Headlines today: how sweet is your baby's tooth? Tonsils and adenoids good for what? And kids succeed with play. Most Americans exceed the daily recommended limits for sugar, and research shows it starts as a baby. One study of 800 infants and toddlers found that 85% consumed added sugar on a given day, and the older they got, the more sugar they ate. 60% of babies aged 6 to 11 months ate almost one teaspoon of added sugar a day. By 12 to 18 months, 98% were consuming 5.5 teaspoons a day. And by 2 years of age, it was over 7 teaspoons of added sugar per day. This added sugar came as cane sugar, high fructose corn syrup, and honey. That's right, honey is an added sweetener. Of course, these exceed the recommended daily limit for added sugars, which is set at 6 teaspoons for women and 9 teaspoons for men. Excess sugar consumption is linked to obesity, asthma, dental cavities, high cholesterol, and high blood pressure. So give your kids some fresh, crunchy carrots instead of candy, and apples instead of apple pie. Having your tonsils or adenoids removed may set you up for infections, allergies, or worse, according to new research. For the first time, researchers have examined the long-term effects of removing tonsils and adenoids in childhood. They looked at the health records of almost 1.2 million Danish children and found that 60,000 had either adenoids, tonsils, or both removed before the age of 9. Having tonsils removed, otherwise known as a tonsillectomy, prevented tonsillitis but tripled the risk of chest infections, asthma, flu, bronchitis, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, in later life. Having adenoids out doubled the risk of COPD, chest infections, and conjunctivitis, though it lowered the risk of sleep disorders. Having both tonsils and adenoids out increased middle ear infections by 4 to 5-fold, and sinusitis went up. These tissues act as the first line of defense in the nose and throat for airborne bacteria and viruses, thereby initiating an early warning system for the immune system. So avoid or delay surgery till your child is older, or assist their immunity by avoiding dairy. Obesity affects 17% of children and adolescents in the US, increasing their risk of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and depression. The Massachusetts-based Build Our Kids Success, or BOKS, program is a 3-month before-school exercise and nutrition program designed to combat these current health trends. Research consistently proves it works. In one recent study, 700 children were offered BOX. 275 did the program twice a week, 150 did it 3 times a week, and the rest acted as controls. At the end of the study, there was no change in the controls or the twice-a-week group. 3 days a week, participants had lower weight, better mood, closer interaction with peers, greater life satisfaction, and better engagement in schoolwork. So ensure your kids have frequent exercise to build better physical, mental, social, and academic success. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's Health News. Today's guest is Dr. Chris Linebury, principal at Stanfield Elementary School and co-author of the book Recess Was My Favourite Subject, Where Did It Go? I asked him how childhood has changed in the last 50 years.
I think it's changed a lot. I think a lot of it has become about sedentary, inside, playing video games, watching videos on online. I think activity has been taken out of childhood in a lot of different ways. I think that parents are more nervous about letting their kids go outside and play now, unsupervised. I know as a parent, I feel that way. But we try and keep our kids active. We have a pool and that kind of thing, and they ride bikes and play sports. But I think it has changed in regard to kids being active and outside playing. I think school has changed. I think school has changed significantly. I think that as a whole, education has become very focused on content and not as focused on children. And I think that's a huge change. You see recess that's been disappearing from schools across our country. In 2006, I think 56% of elementary schools in our country had eliminated recess in the name of improving test scores. So I definitely think that childhood has changed and schools have changed, and I think it's up to us as leaders of schools to make sure that the decisions we're making are in the best interest of children and the whole child, not just their academic progress.
So as play and free play and physical activity has disappeared and that sedentary lifestyle has encroached on childhood, how has mm-hmm. that changed them? And you're talking about the whole child. How has that changed them physically, socially,
you know,
emotionally?
The data that's coming out most recently indicates that the age group that has the highest increase in obesity is children aged 2 to 5. 2 to 5. So I think that that has, you know, that in and of itself says a lot about how children have changed.
Because they haven't even got to school yet.
They haven't even gotten to school yet. So I think a lot has to do with the fact that parents are very busy. They're not eating at home as much. They're eating processed foods or they're eating fast foods, not because they're bad people, but because it's easy and it's quick and people are very scheduled.
Yeah, because in your book you point out that for every 10 hours that a mom works, the rate of obesity goes up in their children? Is that?
And what researchers have found is that the more that a parent is working, especially in single parent homes with the mother, the incidence of obesity increases. With bullying, there's a lot of data that demonstrates that children who are obese are more likely to be targets of bullies, or they're more likely to become bullies themselves.
That's a sad statistic. In the next segment, we hear whether Chris really had a heart attack that day at work. But before the break, watch this.
Alpacas are so cute.
Oh, I don't like alpacas.
Shh, you'll upset them.
I know, in Colorado, my neighbors had them. We'd feed them full handfuls of grass. You know how they'd thank us?
No.
They would spit in our face.
No, you must be thinking of a llama, not an alpaca.
Oh, maybe that's right. I'm sorry, guys. Apologies, apologies.
Yeah. Oh, do you know they remind me that in some places of the world, they carry people's packs for them.
Oh, is that why they're called alpacas?
Maybe it is. But you know, that's like HDL.
Alpacas? HDL? How do you get that? How is
yeah, because HDL is a lipoprotein that carries cholesterol around the bloodstream and gets rid of it. So it's good for reducing heart disease.
Ah, so as alpacas carry packs and HDL carries cholesterol, now I've got the connection.
So we need to raise our HDL as much as possible, because you let it drop even 5 points, you increase your risk of heart disease by 25%.
Wow, so we could call HDLs heavenly darlings, couldn't we?
They can, darling.
So how do you raise your HDLs?
Soy protein and soy isoflavones are two ways that you can do it.
Oh, that sounds heavenly to me.
Yeah, and then you can stop smoking, get 30 minutes moderate intensity exercise every day, and reduce weight. Those all boost your HDL.
Well, my heavenly darling, I'm going to go up there and munch on some tofu, some heavenly tofu.
Great idea. Increase your HDL, stop smoking, have 30 minutes of good exercise every day, and lose weight. Doctor's orders. I am so glad you're with us today, because if you're like me and you love sweets, you are in the right place. Today we're making a sweet treat that's not only delicious but also healthy, and we'll call them healthy scoop cookies, and here's what goes in them. 14 ounces of coconut flakes, 1 cup of quick oats, 1 cup of whole wheat flour, 2 cups of raisins, 1 cup each of dried cranberries, dates and cherries, 2 cups of chopped walnuts, 1 cup of honey, 1 cup of peanut butter, 1 cup of water, and 2 teaspoons of salt.
There's a lot of different ways you can do this, but I need to get you on the wet ingredients.
All right.
So let's go ahead and
oops.
I'll just give that to you.
Oh, yeah.
And you're going to do the wet ingredients. So we've got the honey, the peanut butter, which you're going to have to mix those two first a little bit. If you put the water in there, you're just going to have the swashling, but you're not able to really blend it. So if you just put the things in individually, then you don't have that problem. And then I'm going to work on the dry ingredients over here. Of course, for the dry ingredients, I've got the coconut, which it uses a lot of coconut on this one. It is a...
But, little... you know, if you're a coconut fan like I am, it's perfect.
And your oats, your flour, and I can even put the walnuts in with this.
And so the coconut and the walnuts are going to add your fat, your healthy fats.
A little bit of salt. Did you see how that works, though? Because if you tried to do it with the water in there, it ends up being a problem.
Okay, in it goes.
Yeah, and you can chop those if you want. Sometimes we'll put them in a food processor and chop the
and get a little of that juices out.
Right.
Ooh, nice.
And that works very well, too.
This is starting to remind me of a New Zealand Christmas cake. You know, we always do fruit cake for Christmas, so this is looking not dissimilar. Now, this must be the cherries, huh?
Yep. Ooh. And you can see how much easier it was to blend when you put waited on that water.
Yeah.
And then you get the... Those dates are actually...
They're unusual.
Not real dates. If you got a close-up on this, they're literally a chopped date.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. So
and,
they're pre-chopped for you.
It's 100% pure dates. They just chop it and blend it and turn it into little pebbles. But it's like one-tenth the price of getting
real
dates. Yeah. Okay, we're going to put that right in here.
Oh, this goes into that. All right. Here it comes.
This one feels a little more salt.
You didn't want that added little by little, did you?
Nope.
Because if you did...
Nope, I'm good at blending. We're good at blending. Woo! Okay. Now, let me share with you the reasoning behind this, okay? Because, you know, I like to teach the concept more than the recipe because once you get the concept, then you can really run with it. And basically what you have here is a bunch of products, which you can kind of use any, but you get that flour and water in there, and that's your binding agent. In fact, grab that sheet pan, yeah. So you've got a binder to hold it together. See, that's the whole thing.
Right.
You've got to have a binder. And so your flour, if you're a celiac, you could actually use the coconut flour.
Oh, of course.
Something like that.
An oat flour.
Yeah, just oat flour.
That's my stand-in as I get some gluten-free oats, whiz them up in the blender.
You can see how that's
a nice flour.
Looking pretty good, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And then scoop cookies.
Scoop cookies, got to have the scoop.
And of course you can use any size scoop you want. Usually I over-scoop them and then kind of press them out that they go on the outside like that.
Sorry, that's in your way.
And you can scoop a couple of those.
Roll up the sleeves, put on the gloves.
And you can just basically do it by hand.
Got it.
And like that. These are going to go in the oven for about 40 minutes. And you can see the finished product right there next to you.
Look at your one. It's nice and neat. Huh?
Yeah, you can scoop and mold them that way.
Yeah.
But there you go, just like that.
All right. So we'll do some surgery on this.
Delicious. Simple, healthy, some good energy. You're going on a trip or something like that, but I think they'll love it.
Fantastic. Thanks, Mark. If you missed that recipe, you can find it on our website, hopetv.org/gohealthy. Chris is what you might call an overachiever. At high school, he was a 165-pound champion swimmer who went to the nationals. And he continued to be extremely active, well, that is, until he finished college. As a school teacher, he had no time for physical activity and he rapidly gained 50 pounds. Then he became a school principal with less time and more responsibility. On one particularly stressful day, he experienced chest pain. Watch.
So at 36 years old, I had a heart attack at school. And I left school on a stretcher. I was younger than the majority of the staff. And it scared me. It scared me for a number of reasons. One, I was only 36 years old. Two, I was a single father. And my son depended upon me wholly. And when I got to the hospital, you know, I have some family background. That of heart disease, et cetera, that I'm sure has contributed to what's gone on. But the bulk of what happened to me happened as a direct result of not dealing with stress in an appropriate way. And, you know, stress, schools are a little bit like hospitals in that they're stressful environments. There's really nothing we can do to make school not stressful. But what we can do is change the way that we deal with that stress. And I was not dealing with it well. I was not getting enough sleep. And I had fallen into a bit of a depression. Like, this can't really be happening to me. You know, I'm 36, I'm an athlete, et cetera. And that continued for some time. And I just got to a point where I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I just couldn't do it anymore. And I went to my doctor, I talked to my doctor. And I decided at that time that I was going to make change.
Which is a key step to make. In the first segment, Dr. Chris Linebury was explaining the new emphasis on academics. I asked him how well that has worked for education in the U.S.
Well, you know, if you look at how we rate academically, we rate fairly far behind. And one of the reasons that we rate further behind is because we test everybody. If you were to, people talk about Finland all the time and Finland's outstanding academic achievement. But what we know is that if you take out or account for poverty, the United States crushes the statistics in Finland. And, you know, as a whole, we've always been a bit behind in academic achievement, behind the world. What we have not been behind in and what we have led in has been in innovation. And as we take away play, imaginative play, the opportunity for kids to learn the unwritten curriculum, I think we do a lot to detract from kids' imaginations and from innovation. So I don't think that this has served us well as a country to move in the direction we've moved in with standardized testing.
Now, as we talk about the academic side, let's go to the physical side. We've got a problem with childhood obesity.
We do.
How much does the school contribute to that? You're an educator, and should it even be a problem that a school tries to address?
That's a great question, because sometimes when I talk to groups of teachers, I'll hear teachers say, well, I teach fifth grade, or I teach chemistry. And my counter to that is, you teach children. And if we're teaching children and we're not worried about teaching content, we can teach content to children, but we teach children. So if we're going to teach children, we have, I think, a responsibility to educate the whole child. Research demonstrates that physical activity improves academic achievement. Research demonstrates that students who eat well perform at higher levels. Research demonstrates that if we're hungry and we haven't eaten, it's much more difficult for us to focus. I come from a school where a lot of my students, some of the best meals they get are the ones they get at school. And if we didn't provide that for kids, then a lot of what they got wouldn't be health and wellness centered. So we have gone the extra mile to ensure that the food that we're providing to our students not only meets the USDA's standard, but exceeds it. And I think that's important. And what I would say to school leaders is this: when it comes to academic achievement, we're very quick to say that meeting the standard is not acceptable. We want all kids to exceed the standard.
Because the bar is not that high.
The bar is not that high, but meeting the standard is not good enough when it comes to academics. However, when it comes to nutrition and what's provided in cafeterias, a lot of what I hear is, well, we meet the standard. So we're more concerned with the information that we're putting into heads and that we're getting out of children than we are about the nutrition that we're putting into children. And I think that's something that's got to change, and I absolutely believe that is a responsibility of educators in America.
What about for schools that are calling for better nutrition for their children, but their children are not eating in the school? Is that a hard call, especially if they're not coming from a high income household?
It's tough, because I think then that puts principals and teachers in the position of being food police. And that's definitely not what we want to do. I think the answer is the same as the answer for most things, and that's education. Talking about it, talking to kids about it, and building a culture in a school that focuses on health and wellness, the problem kind of takes care of itself. You know, when I first started this, I had a parent call me and say, "Chris, I really wish that you would stop this." And I said, "What are you talking about?" She says, "My daughter criticizes dinner every single night because I fry a lot of stuff and she tells me how unhealthy it is to fry." So I do think that it makes a difference. Yeah. If we talk about it, if health and wellness, you know, every class in every school in America is a reading class. I believe that's wonderful because if you can't read, you can't take a science test, you can't perform in social studies, you can't perform in language arts, and math requires reading as well. I think health needs to be that integral part of what we do in education also.
Now, something novel you do is you integrate physical activity because that's 60% of the obesity problem. Mm-hmm. You incorporate physical activity into every curriculum in your school.
We do. We do.
Do you get pushback from parents about that?
Not from parents. Some from teachers who are a little uncomfortable with it. But here's the thing. The majority of pushback, and this is extremely important, the majority of pushback that when I talk to educators I get is, I believe, coming from a place of fear. It's fear about this is going to negatively impact our test scores, and that's going to end up putting us in the newspaper for something negative. And it's fear-driven. Once we are able to neutralize that fear with education, educators are wide open to this concept. So what I encourage my teachers to do, what we know in education is that if we can tear down interdisciplinary walls then between areas of study, then we can enhance cognitive function. We enhance learning. If we can get kids moving while they're learning, many of them don't even realize they're learning. And they're having fun while they're doing it. And when they're having fun while they're doing it, we're going to get more out of them academically. We're going to have less behavior problems in class. We're going to have kids who move and learn. And we're going to have teachers who are happier because their students are not only performing at a higher level, but who are happier in general. You know, when I go into classrooms where kids are up and moving and engaged in physical movement while learning, I see a lot of smiles on faces. It's very rare to see a frown. Very rare to see a frown.
Smiles should be made a key performance indicator in education because learning should be fun. Before we go to the break, consider this story about three boys. One night, three young art students were secretly spraying graffiti on a train station so that London commuters could read their tags on their way to and from work. They were seeking fame. The adrenaline rush of avoiding capture was heightened by the risk of standing on the train tracks to do the job. I can't begin to imagine their terror when an unexpected train came barreling down those train tracks. There was no place to run. Their bodies were discovered many hours later as dawn broke. They'd ignored the warnings to stay off the tracks and they didn't expect that train. Many of us ignore health warnings and risk sickness. Sadly, we do the same with our souls. Jesus said we need to watch and be ready for his second coming. He says, at the time we don't expect it, the Son of Man will come and take those who are ready to heaven with him. The remedy is to draw close to him through Bible study, prayer, and service. Then, when Jesus comes, or when our life is over, we won't be filled with fear. We'll be ready and waiting, hearts filled with joy. For a balanced fitness program, strength training is essential. It can slow and prevent the muscle loss that comes with age. And reversing aging is what we're all about. Sean, how are you going to reverse our aging today?
I'm all about reversing the age. And we're going to do a lower body workout today geared to really challenge some of those big muscles, all right? So if you got some big weights, grab the big weights. And strength training is about challenging yourself, all right? So keeping the rep count from like 8 to 12 is a safe bet. but always thinking about, am I really giving my all to each and every step?
Okay. Yeah, could I squeeze another one out?
Yeah.
No, I couldn't.
Yes.
Then you're pitching it right.
Exactly. Sometimes we go with that, do we want to stop or do we need to stop?
Right.
Sometimes you just gotta push yourself, all right?
Yeah.
So we're gonna start with both of our dumbbells. And this is a lower body workout, okay? So I want you to think about your quads, squeezing your quads, a big group right here in the front, okay? We're gonna work on some balance with this first exercise, working both sides.
That's important.
And then we'll get the back side, and then we'll get a little bit more of the entire quad region. So we're gonna start with the split squat, where our back leg is all the way back. Our chest is always rolled back. Our core is engaged. The weight is to the side, and you are stable. There is no rocking, all right? You are like a wall, all right? Nothing is gonna topple you over. Your goal is to bring that back knee down as much as you can with control, come all the way back up and squeezing that front quad in addition to the back quad, all right? This is working your balance, again, going all the way down and all the way back up. The goal here, and I'll allow you to continue to go, is for you again to work on your balance, all right? Work on the quad strength, because you sometimes don't realize one side is stronger than the other. This is a great way to pinpoint if you have some imbalances. And once you do that, you can kind of say, I may need to work on this side a little bit more than the next, okay? So that's good, great form. Again, keeping the core nice and tight. Breathe, inhale through your nose, exhale through your mouth, and we'll switch legs. So same
thing. Otherwise, we'll get jealous.
Yep, that's right. So a good cue here is if you feel like you're going too low, you can put something like a pillow underneath to kind of as a stopping point. But always keep in mind, you're working on balance. You're working on one side at a time and allowing your body to really be challenged by having the weight on both sides.
Yeah, and if you're at a point where you can't even balance, then you might do it without the weight.
Right, right. Right.
And build up.
Yep.
Can of beans.
Can of beans, right? We've done those before, right?
Yeah.
So exercise number two, you can, again, keep 8 to 12 per leg. Exercise number two would be your deadlift, all right? Working the hamstring, the back of the quads, okay? So what we're going to do is keep the weight here on the front, on our quads, and go right forward, all the way down, and all the way back up. A good stopping point would be about mid-shin to stop. All the way down, get a good stretch of your glutes and your hamstring, and come all the way back up, okay? You keep on going, and I'll tell you about some things that typically happen. Now, as you're going down, I want you to keep your eyes facing down. Keep the core nice and tight. Sometimes people get into the habit of bending the knee. You don't want to bend the knee, all right? Number two, you don't want to lock this too much, so you want to have a soft knee.
Okay.
So semi, not locked position, but enough where you can get a good stretch of your hamstring and your glute. All right, come up nice and strong. This is the deadlift, a great powerful exercise for when you're working out in your lower body.
Mm.
All right, do about three more reps. One, there you go. Two, good contraction. Last one, and three. And number three, the third exercise is called a sumo goblet squat. No, I didn't make up the name, okay? So the weight is right here in front, core nice and tight, all the way down and all the way up. Okay, this allows you to work your entire quad, putting everything that we just did in the last two exercises together. Again, your sumo, all right, goblet, squat, feet nice and wide, my toes are intentionally pointing out, core nice and tight, and you are holding on to those weights for dear life, all right? But working as hard as you can.
Yeah. Okay.
Three awesome exercises that you can do to work your lower body. Challenge yourself, burn tons of calories, and have a great time.
Awesome.
All right, let's stretch it out.
Okay.
Let's take one side since you're working on balance. You can hold on to a chair, all right? Three, two, one. Relax, get the other side. Hold it for three.
That feels so
two,
good.
It does. And one, and you are done.
Awesome. Thanks, Sean.
You're welcome.
Colorectal cancer, a leading cause of death in the U.S., usually begins with the growth of benign polyps. The good news is that polyps can be avoided with a high-fiber diet. The Adventist Health Study found that eating legumes at least three times a week, or brown rice once a week, reduced the risk of colon polyps by about 40%. Whole grains and legumes, such as garbanzos, beans, and lentils, are an excellent source of fiber. A high-fiber diet is another ageless advantage.
Now it's time for your questions. Here is our first question. Ruth asks, what causes eczema or eczema? We actually don't know exactly what causes eczema, but I suspect it's a combination of factors that all happen to coincide together that then triggers the skin condition with the itching and the redness and the dryness and the cracking, and it can be such a problem, and it especially affects little ones, so it can be quite distressing for parents to actually see and to deal with. Now, there's often a family history of asthma, eczema, and hay fever. Those three go together, and that sort of suggests that it's genetics, perhaps an abnormal immune response of some kind, and the environment all working together to make it happen. Some of the environmental factors, you can't change your genetics, so let's go to the environmental factors, and they can include living in a cold climate, living in urban areas rather than out in rural areas, and then wearing wool or other irritating fibers that sort of rub and scratch the skin. So cotton can be good to wear, or very soft fabrics can be really helpful for eczema or eczema. Now, activities can make the skin more sensitive, like sweating. And so avoid overheating and then becoming chilled. So, you know, you overheat, you sweat, and then you become chilled. That can be quite irritating for the skin. Then if the skin dries out and cracks, moisture is lost and eczema can break out and become a problem. So avoid prolonged exposure to water, like a long soak in the bath. That's a no-no for someone with eczema. Avoid harsh soaps and cleansers, makeup, chlorine, solvents. So if you've got it on your hands, you're going to always want to wear probably a non-latex gloves to protect yourself from all of these chemicals. Don't wear perfume. Avoid smoking. And if you're having a bath, make it a short bath, less than 10 to 15 minutes. Same with showering, and warm, not hot, because when it's hot, it strips more oils off of our skin. Use a gentle soap, and then straight after a bath or a shower, use a lubricant or a barrier cream to reduce the risk of irritation and exposure to allergens. Someone else called with a question, is it safe to have a colonoscopy while you are taking blood thinners? Well, during a colonoscopy, it's a flexible tube with a fibre optic camera on the end. It's inserted into the rectum and it's used to examine the internal wall of the colon, looking for things like polyps, ulcers, or other abnormalities. Well, little biopsies can be taken, but because they're so small, generally speaking, there's not a lot of bleeding, and so blood thinners are continued because this is not surgery, it's simply an exploratory look around, maybe a little biopsy. Now, if you're on warfarin, though, your doctor may want to be sure that your blood test is at the lower end of the treatment range rather than your blood being very thin. So that's a little caution, but only if you're on the warfarin or the Coumadin. Here's our next question. Does turmeric help with irritable bowel syndrome? Well, there is no evidence to say that turmeric is helpful in irritable bowel syndrome. There is some research in rats that say they have a gastrointestinal response to turmeric, but that doesn't mean that it will have any impact in humans, and in fact, no studies have proven that. Now, if you have a question and you want to send it in, you can send it by through our website, email, text, or phone. Now, let's see what's up for dinner. Pears are classified based on their origin as Asian or European pears. Asian varieties are crispy and firm. Their consistency doesn't change after harvesting or storage, so they're ready to eat. Pears are a great source of fiber, each containing over 5 grams. Regular consumption of pears may provide protection against colon cancer. They're a good source of minerals like copper, iron, potassium, manganese, and magnesium, and also B vitamins. High in antioxidants, they're the least allergenic of all fruits. They've also been used in traditional medicines to treat colitis, gallbladder disorders, arthritis, and gout because of their mild anti-inflammatory properties. Apart from eating them raw, a great way to eat pears is to blend them with a small handful of raw cashews and turn them into pear cream. Bon appetit. Dr. Chris Linebury is co-author of the book, Recess Was My Favorite Subject, Where Did It Go?
It promotes the use of movement and exercise in the classroom. I asked him how he integrates that into the curriculum across the board.
I think one of my favorite lessons is I had a first grade teacher who was teaching math to her students. So I'm in the classroom, and she had them go back. She had them in centers, so it's differentiated instruction, small groups all around the room doing different activity. And in the back of the room, she had one of those carpets that the primary teachers have with the blocks on them. So the kids sit there in the morning for morning meeting and all of that. But what she had done was she had put an exercise on each of the blocks, and she had a spinner. The kids flicked the spinner. If it landed on five, they hop five spaces on the blocks. Whatever that activity was, they did five reps of that activity. So if it was push-ups, they did five push-ups. Then they had to get up and they had to tally the number of whatever they did. At the end of it, they had to add up everything that they had tallied. So this teacher, through movement, had kids learning grouping. She had them learning addition. And she had them smiling and having a good time. They were all engaged.
Wow. And what about a science? I mean, we're always told, stay in your seat. I mean, how do you build this even into a science curriculum?
Well, I think that it's about, you know, that's where the educator really comes in, because teachers know their stuff. And it's just a matter of giving them, planting the seed of the idea of movement into instruction and showing them how to do it. So here's an example in an inquiry-based lesson.
So there's not a particular way they do it. They just build off of it.
They build off of it, but they build off the concept. So one of the strategies that we teach is called kick me. You remember when you were in school and kids would put like a sticker on somebody's back that said kick me?
Yes.
Well, this is an inquiry-based lesson. So if I'm teaching a social studies class, or let's say I'm teaching a science class, and I'm asking how do we think they solved this problem, I have all the kids write it on a note, on a sticky note. Then they put it on their own back. Then they have to get up around the room and they have to find somebody who has the same answer that they do. And they have to talk to that person about why they gave the answer they gave, and then they have to share why they gave their answer. So we've got kids up and moving. We've got them sharing ideas. I can switch that around and say, find somebody who wrote something completely different than you. Now I've got kids getting up and engaging in discussion about a point of view that they didn't even consider.
So they're in debate class then.
They're learning, and they're moving.
You know, going back to the food question, mm-hmm. You know, kids are very idealistic, and I love how your parent is ringing up and saying,
"It's great."
It is great, but food is very addictive. That salt, that sugar, that fat. How do you sort of work on those addictions within a school environment?
So what we do is we give kids choices, and again, I think it all boils down to education. What we offer our students, I have a bit of an easier road than some schools, because all of my students are on get free lunch and free breakfast and free snacks, so they eat what we provide them. That being said, it's about making those choices aesthetically pleasing and making them taste good. We have a lot of kids who've never heard of a star fruit, much less tasted it. So if the fruit that we're putting out is star fruit, they're more likely to try it. They may be a bit hesitant, but they're more likely to try it.
Peer pressure, you mean? You're educating them.
I think curiosity.
Right.
You know, what is that? And I wonder what that tastes like. And you taste it, and I'll taste it. And then you get kids who start to engage. We have a full salad bar that our kids go through every day. And they take fruit and vegetables off that salad bar every single day. And I believe that it's because our teachers have done a good job of talking to them about the importance of nutrition and fresh food, but also because they like it. They like it because it's fresh. You know, it's different than going to a grocery store in impoverished areas. Food's not as fresh as it is in more affluent areas. So instead of being yellow, bananas might be brown. So seeing that fresh fruit and tasting that fresh fruit and vegetables, I think, makes a big difference.
Mm. Now, you say that when you became a principal, you required kids to have physical education 4 days a week, mm-hmm. and created a place where kids felt safe and wanted to be at school.
Absolutely.
Why were those things so important to you?
again, I think it goes back to teaching the whole child. You know, I told my teachers that if they took away recess as a form of punishment, that I would take away math or reading. And they looked at me the way you just did. They looked at me like I was absolutely nuts. And then this summer, the American Academy of Pediatrics came out and said that recess and physical education are just as important to the education of a child as reading and math. So I've made it a priority. And that's a stake that I've put in the ground that I'm willing to climb the hill for, so to speak. When you talk about the education of the whole child, it's all about relationships. And I think what it means for me is connecting to that why, that reason that I became an educator, which was I want to help kids, not just academically. I want to help them to live better, fuller lives. So I have some students at my school who one night in February of 2017, three of their brothers were riding dirt bikes out on the highway near us, near our school. A drunk driver hit them and killed two of them. That happened at about 2 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday, on a Sunday morning, Saturday night. Those kids were at school Monday. February of 2018, the third brother of those three that were on the road, two who were killed, one who wasn't, the third brother was killed on Valentine's Day. Those kids came to school the next day, the younger brothers. That's why the education of the whole child is so important to me. They knew when their world was falling apart that we were a place that they could come. And I'm much more worried about that than I am about anything else, because if I have that kind of relationship with them, they're going to work harder for me. They're going to work harder for themselves. They're going to begin to believe a little bit more in themselves. And I'm going to be able to help them and pull resources to help them get through whatever challenge it is that comes in front of them. It's about, I think, teaching kids resilience, persistence, and kindness. And so that's why it's so important to me, because when I have things like that happen, you know, I go home that night and I know I've made a difference, which is why I became an educator in the first place.
That's a home run right there. More in the last segment, so stick around. As a principal, Chris Linebury was carried out of school on a stretcher having a heart attack at the age of 36. It was his wake-up call. After coming to terms with it, he took action. He learned how to manage stress better, he slept more, and he regained the fitness he'd had in his youth. Here's how life is now. What?
I started taking better care of myself. I started eating better. I still don't eat as well as I probably should. But I have become much more focused on the impact that my health has on the lives of my children. I have two small children now, 6 and 7 years old. I have a beautiful wife, and she has some children. We have stepchildren together, and I love them all dearly, and I want to be around. So I made the changes that I've made. You know, at 47 years old, I bench pressed 275 pounds, which, you know, is not a world record by any stretch of the imagination. However, that's the most weight I've ever lifted in my life. And I did it at 47 years old. If you do a better job of taking care of yourself, you're going to be better equipped to help take care of other people. And my purpose today is to be not only the best example that I can be to my children and the kids that I work with in my school, but to also be of service. And I can't be of very much service if I'm not taking good care of myself. It's not that hard. And I think that if I were to go back to my former self, I would say to myself, it's not that hard. You know, you don't have to go out and run a marathon in order to make a positive change in your life.
It's about doing small things. It's about taking the stairs instead of the elevator. It's about maybe parking further away from the door. It's not about being able to get in the water and swim 7,500 yards every day, but it may be about getting in the water and swimming. It's not about how much weight you can lift or whether you're in there 5 days a week. It's whether or not you get in there on a regular basis and you push yourself. And so today, I think that, you know, I tend to learn very well from pain. Pain is an excellent teacher. And I think another thing I would say to that former me is you don't have to wait for it to hurt to bring about change. That the change can happen much sooner and be just as effective.
For sure. I asked Dr. Limebury how Stanfield Elementary School in a tiny rural town in Arizona became one of the top three healthiest schools in America.
The journey began 5 years ago. And within the first year of being at Stanfield, we were the first school and only school in Arizona to ever win the Gold with Distinction Award from the USDA. They have a Healthier U.S. Schools Challenge criteria awarding system. They go bronze, silver, gold, and gold with distinction. We won gold with distinction. That was only a few years ago. After that, we then became one of the NFL Play 60's touchdown schools. We were awarded the bronze by the Alliance for a Healthier Generation, the silver by the Alliance for a Healthier Generation, and named as one of the healthiest schools in America. We then applied for and received a grant from the National Foundation of Governors Fitness Councils for a $100,000 fitness center, which was placed in our school. And we had our governor and Body by Jake Steinfield, came out and presented that to us. We recently won a mountain bike grant. So now, as part of our PE curriculum, we teach mountain biking to our middle school students. The machines that we got in that physical fitness center are all made for children fifth grade and up. So we've had an opportunity to get kids working out and being physically active and building strength at a very young age. We also have a mud run course at our school. So we do a mud run every year where we have the kids come out. I have a teacher who a few years ago, she was in her 70s, and we ended the mud run with a belly slide on trash bags with soap on them. And at 73, 74 years old, right down the slide, the kids had a blast doing it. We had parents come out and do it. So we've done a number of things like that. We do health fairs every year.
For your community.
For our community, mm-hmm. where we bring in dental offices, or we bring in the Lions Club, who will do vision screenings, the YMCA.
So tell me about your community and why they need those outreaches.
We are the center of the community. In the 2015 census, our average annual population for a household of four was $5,000 a year.
Average income of a household,
$5,000 a year. There's not much around us. We're pretty remote. So the ability for somebody to be able to go to the school and work out is huge. We have a track.
But these children should not be excelling. If you look at socioeconomic data, these children should not be excelling physically or academically, yet they are.
They are. They are, and our academic scores aren't where we want them to be yet, but we're showing improvement. With 45 minutes of physical activity every day, with PE every day.
On top of your 45 minutes?
On top of that 45 minutes every day, my students' academic performance increased by 5% last year. It didn't decrease. And I often hear, you know, one of the things that I wanted to start when I got to the school was I wanted to bring technology on board. My superintendent wanted to bring technology on board. We didn't have internet. And I had people tell me, you need to realize where you are. You're in the middle of nowhere and you can't do this. And my response to them is, don't tell me what I can and can't do. And where I am isn't what matters. Where I want to go is what's important. Today, every student in our school in grade 1 through 8 has their own laptop. We have smart boards in every single classroom. We have We just won a $1 million grant to have internet cable wired out to our school. So where we are or where you are isn't as important as where you want to go. And if your why is big enough, and my why, I believe that my why is bigger than any obstacle that's going to be put in front of me. And if my why is bigger than the obstacle, my why will win every single time. And my kids, my teachers wear shirts that say, "Ask me my why." And I'll have kids or parents who say, "What's your why?" And my answer to them is, "My why is you. You're why I'm here." Okay.
So you won all the awards. Mm-hmm. What did they assess in your students?
A variety of things, from what we serve in the cafeteria to the minutes of health and wellness or healthy recess that we provide every day or PE every week, to the amount of space that the kids have to exercise in, to whether or not we have a school garden on our site, which we do. All of those things combined together with our staff, we've won awards for staff health and wellness as well. And that has to do with everything from having a staff wellness committee, school health advisory council, to having breastfeeding rooms for our teachers who have just given birth so that they can pump while they're at school. So it's a whole school kind of an assessment that looks at the culture of the school and whether it promotes health and wellness.
Which sounds amazing. Whether you're a parent or an educator, be sure your kids get an hour of physical activity every day. It's going to help them physically, emotionally, socially, and academically. And the bonus? Better behavior. Education around the world needs a revolution, a health revolution like this. If you want to know more, buy the book, Recess Was My Favorite Subject, Where Did It Go? That's all for me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.